Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this is the last of our almost live coverage of the 74th annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. Now, almost live is getting a bit far stretched for this episode. I think we should probably call it quite promptly edited. So after all the lectures and posters on the last day, we had the award ceremony and then the after party. So hopefully you can all let me off a day to go to these events, and then having spent the next couple of days recuperating. I want to pass on our thanks to the SVP who've had us back at their conference, and we hope you've all enjoyed listening to our coverage. Whilst we were there, we managed to record our next few interviews, which are really ones to listen out for, especially for all you dinosaur fans. And the next SVP meeting will be in Dallas, so hopefully we'll be reporting from there again. Our next conference, though, is the Paleontological Association's annual general meeting, which will be held in Leeds on the 16th to 19th of December. We'll be live streaming that conference, so tune in to watch all the presentations. But for now, I hope you enjoy the rest of our time in Berlin. I'm looking at a poster about improving the collaboration between paleontologists and paleo artists, and Simone Magnuco is here. And Simone, can you tell us what it is you're trying to do?
Yeah, we want to create a database to give to the artist more data to make more accurate artworks. In this case, we focused our attention on Styracosaurus, and we provide them a new skeletal reconstruction, a reconstruction of the musculature, a digital model to be viewed in different views, and then a list of the fauna, of the flora, and of the environment of the age in which Styracosaurus lived. And they started from our data and prepared several artworks. We have different ones in this process, but this is only the beginning of the project. We are working to prepare a paper in the future, and there will be many more artworks from several artists.
So, as a paleontologist, do you think there's a problem with how paleo artists are drawing dinosaurs at the moment? Do you think that they could be doing a better job of being more accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I think so because we have experienced in our traveling exhibition with flesh models that if the models are based on scientific data, people appreciate them much more than if they are not based on data, because they become more close to real animals, to natural animals. So I think that paleo art can improve, yeah, can change and improve thanks to this kind of collaboration between paleo artists and paleontologists. Also, paleontologists can learn something from paleo artists, because there are many questions by paleo artists that are useful for the paleontologists to go back to the fossils, to look at them, to reply to the paleo artists. For example, it is often they demanded about the musculature, the posture, and we need to study better the specimens to understand the problem and to give them the solution of their questions.
So on your poster, you've got a timeline of Styracosaurus reconstructions by various different paleo artists. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a dinosaur expert, but I can see from the very first image that you've got from 1916, that's a Styracosaurus. It's a ceratopsian with lots of spikes coming out from the back of its neck frill. But then I look all the way through all of the images throughout time up until the present day, but they all just look like Styracosaurus. And so, I am not a
dinosaur expert, but I can still identify Styracosaurus at each stage. Why is it important to show the public the accurate model?
It's not a simple question, but it's important because, basically, you can recognize the animal also in the oldest representations. But in the new ones, you can understand something about the life of the animal. You can see the animal like a living animal with different proportions that are closer, for example, to modern birds than modern reptiles. So you can understand that there is a link between dinosaurs and birds, for example. You can also people can see that dinosaurs are more bird-like than reptile-like, for example. And I think that this is important because this reflects the change in science.
And so could your database be continually updated new scientific discoveries are made? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, best of luck with it, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So here at this conference, we've seen a whole array of beautifully preserved fossils and wonderful Lagerstätte. But what happens if one of those sites comes under threat from, say, development? I'm here with Georgia Knaus, who's been looking at mitigation in paleontology. So can you tell us what are some of the issues threatening paleontological sites?
Really, any type of surface development in areas that are known to have paleontological potential. So areas where we've found important fossils in the past, or maybe areas that where no work has ever been done. So oil and gas development, pipelines, wind farms, solar, anything.
Okay, but there's so much development going on all the time, all over the world. Who's going to say to these construction companies, hang on, you might want to check in all of these rocks first just to see if there's any fossils in them?
Well, it really depends on where you're located. In the United States, it's depending on the government agency, and it's either federal or in some areas it'll be state or even local. Cities and towns have their own laws, and they will tell the companies that are the proponents that are planning to do the work that they need to do a paleontological analysis. In other countries, it depends on it's either the state or maybe at the government.
So you're coming up with some best practices for mitigation. What would they involve?
We actually have 10 categories, so I'll just mention those. It's qualifications and training, because a lot of time has been spent on who's qualified to do this work and how is that determined, because there's not very many degrees in paleontology and definitely not in paleontological mitigation. Then we have analysis of existing data and what's the best way to do that and what resources you should use. Research models and scientific contests, if that's important or not. Field data collection, field surveys, construction monitoring, fossil salvage, data management and reporting, curation of facilities, and business ethics and scientific rigor, which is something you may not always think about, especially the business ethics in general paleontological studies.
Do you have any examples of where a fossil site has been completely destroyed by a development?
Probably more than I want to, so I'll just, in the Uinta Basin in Utah, in the United States, there's been a oil and gas development for a number of years and on federal land, and there's been a lot of research in that area for a long time, and not all of those localities were reported to the governmental agency, and so no one knew besides the researcher that the site existed, and the consultants that maybe were brought in or maybe they were not didn't check rigorously with each researcher that could be working there, and so a few very well producing sites were completely destroyed by well pads and roads. And then other places, for example, I just spent the last week in Germany touring different Lagerstätte deposits, which have all been found in mines, travertine mines, copper mines, mines that are used for building material. And all of those have produced some of our most famous fossils, well known. And honestly, if it hadn't been for those actual excavations. We would never have those fossils. So it's not all bad. It's just that you need to have someone there that's looking at the rock.
So I look at some horrible little arthropods that I don't think a single paleontologist in this room has ever heard of, let alone cares about. So I'm sure there's many paleontologists all around the world saying, what about my fossils? Mine are the important ones. Who's going to be looking out for those?
That's a really good point, and that's something that why we've developed these best practices is to explain to people and to remind everyone that it's not just about what they know and it's not just about what they think is important, but you have to take, it's all fossils, it depends on where you are, but even on the federal land in the U.S., it's all fossils that have a scientific value are considered important and need to be protected. And so it's important to do a thorough background research for all different types of fossils, from invertebrates to plants to the amazing, you know, things that people love, like T-Rex.
And chasmotaspidids. Okay,
and
thank you.
And turtles that nobody likes.
And turtles. Okay, thanks very much.
So we've just been talking about paleontological mitigation, which is how we stop things being damaged when we're trying to take them out of sight. But now I've got Suzanne Goldberg and Amy Davison with me from the American Museum of Natural History, who are going to talk about what the process is and what we do when that doesn't quite work, when things do get broken as we take them out of the field. Hello.
Hello.
So I guess the first question is, what have we got up here on the poster?
Well, we have various adhesives that we use at the AM&H, that we use in the field and then back at the museum after we've brought specimens back.
And is there a particular type of adhesive that you have to use in particular different situations? How do you decide that process?
That's exactly what this poster's about. Adhesives are really important for fossil collecting because they tend to break. They tend to break when you're trying to take them out of the ground. They break as you're preparing them, as you're exposing them for research, and they also break after they're finished just sitting in the collections. They're very, very brittle. So adhesives are actually really, really important to all aspects of vertebrate paleontology. So this poster is explaining there's six different adhesives that we use, and we have pictures of our specimens and when we use the pictures to show when we're choosing one adhesive over another, depending on how the adhesive acts. Some of them are thick, some of them are sticky, some of them are thin and flow into cracks. Some of them are for, like, if specimen's wet. So they all have different properties, and as preparators, we have to understand those properties, be able to pick. It's like our palate. Whatever problem we have, we know we have those six to choose from, and we can pick the one that's most appropriate for the task that we need to accomplish.
So it sounds like potentially it'd be quite a painstaking process. How long do these sorts of things usually take, and how do you go about it? Is it like fitting a jigsaw puzzle together?
Well, you're talking about just one aspect, which is if you found a lot of pieces broken up, or if somebody dropped a big bone on the floor, you have a lot of pieces. That's one thing, is sticking things together. When I say adhesive, I mean it also includes like what we call consolidants. When you have very thin adhesive, very watery adhesive that you flow into the specimen to try and make it a little harder so that it won't fall apart when you're handling it. So what you're talking about is fitting little pieces together like a jigsaw puzzle. That's important, but there's other steps in the process that are also important. So we need adhesives for every different situation. If you know the adhesive, you can save a lot of time. And you can also save a lot of time later on if you know what it is and how to remove it. That's also an important aspect of the adhesive, is knowing how to remove it is necessary. So fossil collecting and preparation and repairs is very complicated, and so we need a lot of different adhesives to do lots of different jobs.
So it would be the case that every fossil that comes into the museum, to the preparators, would have to go through some kind of process along these lines?
Suzanne's been in Mongolia for, she and I have mostly worked in Mongolia in the Gobi Desert, so you can explain when you use adhesives for that.
Sure. Yeah, and you wanted to know, like, how long is the process and, like, what happens from the first time you find it until it's finally prepared. Usually when you find it in the field, you often see, like, a tiny piece of it, a tiny piece of the fossil, like, sticking out from the ground. And it could be like half, or it could be like one hundredths of the fossil. You could just see like one little, you know, finger bone from an entire skeleton. So you have to kind of explore and just like carefully brush away the sand. So in the Gobi Desert, there's a loose sand. And so you slowly brush away the sand and kind of work around one area that you found to see if there's more underneath. And if you find more, you keep working around and, you know, increasing the area that you're working. And if it looks like something worth keeping, you would usually put some consolidant in the Gobi. We use Butbar B76. And then we would go ahead and do like a plaster jacket if it's a large specimen, or if it's like extremely fragile or, you know, really special. So we make the plaster jacket, and then that's kind of a long process. You have to do one side, and then you have to carefully like trench around it, flip it, let that dry, do the other side. Then you have to transport that back to your field site, transport that back to the city of Ulaanbaatar. Then it has to go through a process of permits and going through the Academy of Sciences in Mongolia to get permission to be shipped to New York, and which can take years.
Okay, so it sounds like really it's a much more involved process than probably most of us realize. You know, we see these fossils just up in museums that are perfect, but it's right from the very beginning when you first find it, and there's all sorts of stages that are taken.
Right, and that's only the first part, really, because then once you get it back to the museum, it again could take months or years to fully prepare the specimen. But also, preparators back at the museum are working on other things, so it takes time, and we still have many specimens from Mongolia that haven't even been opened.
Okay, well, thank you very much for all your effort in making these fossils nice for us to look at on display.
Thank you.
I'm with Lindsay Zano, who's Director of Paleontology at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, who's got a poster here at the conference about a therizinosaurian mass death locality and a new taxon. So I guess the first question is, what is a therizinosaurian?
Therizinosaurs are really bizarre theropod dinosaurs. Theropods are the group that includes birds and things like Tyrannosaurus rex and Velociraptors. So we like to think of them as small, agile carnivores. But there are several theropods that actually have really weird bird-like morphology. And so therizinosaurs are a group that was feathered, and they had really bizarre bodies, including large pot bellies and four-toed feet, long necks and tiny heads, little beaks, and really, really long claws. So they're kind of like a combination between an ostrich and Edward Scissorhands and a gorilla. So really kind of Frankenstein-ish dinosaur.
And do you have a good idea at all of their sort of mode of life, why they had all these weird features?
Well, we do. One of the things that we're starting to understand is that a lot of these bird-like theropod dinosaurs did different things. So they weren't just predators. They ate various parts of plants and perhaps meat and plants. And so that means that their anatomy is going to change to evolve to eating different things. And so therizinosaurs are clearly adapted to eating at least some plant material. So that's why they look so different to their close relatives.
And the next part of the title, a mass death locality, what does that mean?
Well, a mass death site is a way of saying that many, many, many individuals of the same species were buried together. So it's kind of like a paleo mystery or a prehistoric forensics. We find this quarry and it has probably around 300 individuals of this particular dinosaur buried there. And then we have to tease apart the evidence to try and figure out the mystery of how they all gotten at one place.
And have you figured it out? Why are they all there?
No, we haven't. I mean, this particular site has been worked for about 10 years, but it's so densely packed with bone, we only get a little bit into the hill each year. We've probably collected over 3,000 bones from this site, but we're getting new pieces of information all the time. So some of the bones are diseased, and so now we're studying whether that particular disease may have had anything to do with why they died and were buried there.
And the focus of your poster seems to be that you found a new taxon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we actually found two of these Mathdesk sites, and when we found the second one, it was right next to the first, and it was very similar in the skeleton, so we thought it was the same animal. But it turns out it's actually a slightly different animal. So now we have this really great sample of two closely related species of feathered theropod, which is really rare globally. It's one of the biggest assemblages of a feathered theropod that we have in the world. And so we can ask different questions than paleontologists can typically ask because we have enough data to really get at big picture processes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for chatting with us.
Okay, thanks.
So on social media, if you see any kind of cartoon about paleontology, it's normally having a knock at tyrannosaurid arms, how puny they are, how feeble they are, and how tiny they are. And Corwin Sullivan at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology in Beijing has been looking at tyrannosaurid forearms. So could you tell us a little bit about these, please?
Well, these are actually tyrannosauroid forelimbs. So tyrannosaurids is only the most evolutionarily derived ones, such as Tyrannosaurus and Gorgosaurus. Tyrannosauroids is the broader group, which includes the animal we've been looking at, a basal tyrannosauroid called Guanlong Wuzai from the Jurassic of China.
Okay, so did this have particularly interesting arms, different to any of the other more advanced tyrannosaurids?
Well, so tyrannosaurids, the advanced ones, had very reduced forelimbs, whereas the forelimbs of Guanlong are a lot more similar to those of other theropods. In other words, we say that they're generalized. So in a way, I'm looking at these arms precisely because, by the standards of theropod dinosaurs, they're sort of boring, right? They're a good one to start with, to work up, to model, and to get an idea of how the forelimbs of theropod dinosaurs might have functioned in general.
Okay, so you've been modeling them. What have you worked out about their functionality? Can you ascertain things like how hard it could grip things or what its reach was?
Well, I've been looking specifically at the question of grasping. So yes, how well could Guanlong get a grip on prey or on whatever else it wanted to hold? So I've been creating digital models of the fingers of Guanlong and essentially bending them around cylinders of different diameters to get a feeling for which parts of the finger would have contacted the cylinder and how well each digit could grip. And to make a long story short, my co-authors and I should be clear that this isn't just my work, but we've been finding that it seems like it could grip fairly well, but only by using the claws. So that is, the claws could take objects and pin them against the more proximal parts of the hand, the ones that are closer to the palm. But the other segments of the finger probably couldn't do much. Gripping really was all about sinking claws into things and using claws to pin things against the rest of the hand.
So is that why in things like Tyrannosaurus rex, that even though they had a very reduced forearm, the fact that they had the claws still meant that the arm could function?
The question of what Tyrannosaurus was doing with its very reduced, even puny, dare I say it, little arms is actually a very interesting one. I don't think we know the answer. It retains its claws, as you said. It also looks like the limb retained a fair bit of musculature. The muscle attachment surfaces on the bones are still there. So it was doing something with its hands, but it's very hard to say what.
So who have you been working with in this study?
Well, I've got two co-authors. One of them is Xu Xing, who's probably China's leading expert on theropod dinosaurs. The other is a fellow called Yu Yilun, who's a high school student in Beijing. It's very unusual for a high school student to be a co-author on a poster presented at a scientific conference. But Yilun is attending a high school in Beijing that required him to do a science project. So he came to Xu Xing, my other co-author, and asked if he could do a science project on a dinosaur. So Xu suggested that he work on the hand of Guanlong, suggested that I help, and here we are. And Yilun was a lot of fun to work with.
So how old is he?
I don't know exactly. I would guess 17. I think he's just finishing high school.
Okay. And would you encourage more students to go out and work with paleontologists?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my experience with Ilun has been entirely positive. And we always have things that need to be worked on that we don't have time for. So a keen high school student who's prepared to put in a bit of work and learn how to do it properly, it really is a godsend. And I think it works very well for both ends of the relationship because we get someone to help with our work. And for a young person in that position, it's a great way to get some experience, not just of paleontology and dinosaurs, but of scientific research and working with scientists in general.
Okay, Corin, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So I have Benjamin Ramasamy, who is at the Natural History Museum of Denmark, and he's found a new genus of long-snouted beaked whale. So can you tell us what these whales were and how they lived? Do we still get them today?
Yeah, sure. Well, beaked whales are still present today. Actually, they are the second largest group in the whales, but we know almost nothing about them, and it's due to their ecology, because they are deep divers, and they search for food, for squids. So they are deep diving more than 1,000 meters, more than 1 hour. And we know basically nothing about the extant species. And that's where paleontology is very interesting, in my opinion, and morphology is interesting, because you can relate what you find in the fossil and the extant to better understand the ecology of the extant beaked whale. And that's what I have tried to do with this new fossil. So try to understand the ecology of this new beaked whale we have found in Kram, and how the extant beaked whale got their main adaptation to suction feeding and deep dive.
So, they have suction feeding. How does that work?
Oh, suction feeding. So when you are in the water, you have two ways of feeding. Ram feeding, which is basically catching your prey actively. So for example, a dolphin with a lot of teeth, omodont teeth, they catch their prey actively. Or you use suction feeding, which is the lazy way of whales. So what they are doing is, like when you're sucking with a straw, you're absorbing the air in the straw, and so it creates negative pressure, and so the water is getting inside your mouth. So what they are doing is increasing the size of their oral cavity, and the water is getting inside, and they catch the prey this way, or transporting also prey and then ingesting it.
So is that why they're long snouted? Is it the same as just having a big straw at the front of the mouth?
Yeah, it's a bit like that. And it's very weird in whales, because if you watch other whales that are using suction, you don't see this adaptation, this long snout. Actually, they have a very short snout. And it's because in other whales, what they are using to create this depression is they have a very enclosed cavity with cheeks and use soft bodies to close their oral cavity, and they can create so this intraoral depression. But in the case of beaked whales, they have a longer snout and have ossification, protuberized ossification to enclose the cavity. And with throat grooves like baleen whales have, increase the size of the oral cavity and create this negative pressure.
Okay, so you found a new species.
Yeah.
Where is this found and how old is it?
It has been found in Denmark. It's in the southern Jutland. It's the first species of big whale we have found in Denmark. And the site is 10 million years old, actually. So for big whale, it's old, but not the oldest. The oldest has been found in Antwerp, and he's 15 million years old.
And so has this told us anything new about the evolution of long-snouted beaked whales?
Yeah, definitely. You have on the specimen, on the rostrum, a very strange feature, ventral concavity.
Oh, what a nice specimen. Just saying so.
No, that's
wrong. Just random appreciation. Is this your supervisor or?
No, that's the person we prepared the specimen.
Oh yeah, it is a really lovely prepared specimen. Yeah. Now that you mention it, and she's walked off. Now she's embarrassed.
Yes.
Sorry. So the beautiful preparation has enabled us to see this ventral concavity in the rostrum. You were saying yes. Yeah.
So we got this ventral concavity, which is pretty new in beaked whales. It's not something you see usually. So like I said, you need to have an enclosed cavity to create a negative pressure, so the water cannot get out of your oral cavity. In other beaked whales, they have protuberance on the mandible, but on this species, it's a ventral concavity you have on the rostrum, but it's straight on the rostrum. You don't find it on beaked whales, but you find it on other species like the walrus, for example. So the walrus has a ventral concavity, which is similar and is known as an obligatory suction feeder. There is also some new things on sexual dimorphism. So beaked whales are known to have a huge sexual dimorphism. The males are very different from the females. They have very different skulls and have modified teeth, tusks, so, which they use for fight, a bit like a boar, for example. All the beaked whales have that, and we find this also on fossils. These fossils has two pair of tusks, and in the extinct one, you just find one pair of tusks. And my hypothesis is that, in fact, the fact to have two pair of tusks is due to the fact that these tusks are situated at the apex. And it's related to suction feeding. So when you use suction feeding, your teeth are worn by the passage of fluids or prey items at the level of the opening, and the tusks get very worn. And on this specimen, the apical tusk is extremely worn, but the subapical tusk is not worn. So having two pair of tusks is an advantage because you can keep, even if the first pair of tusks is completely worn, you still have the second pair of tusks that you can use in the trespass, and so you can fight longer.
And then, is there any geological evidence as to the ecology of this new specimen? Did you find it in a really deep, deep water setting?
It's a very good question. Actually, the place where the species has been found is shallow waters, and you don't expect that because the extinct beaked whales are living in deep water. The problem is that the carcass of whales can, you know, strand very far from where they are dying. So we cannot be sure for now that the specimen is really from this location. And that's something that we want to answer by using isotopic analysis. So basically, with isotopic analysis, you would be able to know if the animal is estuarine, living in estuarine waters or open sea waters. And so being able to know if the animal is from this locality. It would be really huge to know that, because it would be better to understand how the animals are acquired the adaptation to deep dive.
Okay, thank you very much, Benjamin.
Yeah.
It takes something special to be interviewed multiple times on PaleoCast. And yet we've got Betsy Crook here back within, 3 days?
Yeah, sounds about right.
And something special. I think Dino 101 can be described as something special. Why don't you tell us about that?
So Dino 101 is called a MOOC. It's a massive open online course all about dinosaurs. So it's multidisciplinary. So we talk about biology, evolution, anatomy, a little bit of geology, and plate tectonics. And it's a really great way to allow people who might not necessarily be able to take traditional education, or who can't go back to school, or just even people who want to try out a college course, to kind of bring them into the world of science and about dinosaurs.
So is it basically a college course that you can take online?
Yep, you can take it online for free. It's technically at a 200 level, but we've had students from early high school be able to take it as well.
Okay, at 200 level for people not in the US?
Second year level in undergrad?
Okay, so not freshman year after. So it's pretty high level course.
Yes and no. We have students that are, you know, art students, business students, people not in science actually taking it at the University of Alberta for credit.
So how many people have actually taken this course so far?
Throughout all the versions, I think it's up to 50,000 people have started this course.
That's quite a lot.
That is a lot of people that have now seen my face.
So are you the star?
Yeah, that's what you can call me. You definitely see majority of the videos. I am doing the lectures. There's a little bit of Dr. Phil Curry and Dr. Victoria Arbor and Dr. Matt Baverick, but yeah, you see a lot of me in those videos.
So how do the lectures actually take shape? Is it all just video? Because you can't get physical materials to the person taking the course. It's all got to be just pictures and videos.
Actually, that's not entirely correct. So yes, there are a lot of videos. They're really short, 2 to 5 minute videos, maybe some longer, going over the different things. But then we also have mini in-lecture quizzes where we kind of take a pause and ask a question and kind of judge, so you can judge where you are. But not only that, a lot of our production team actually comes from a video game background. And so we've got various interactive elements, not only the in-lecture quizzes and the end-of-chapter quizzes, but we've got a 3D fossil viewer where we put fossils through a CT scan and then made a 3D model of them that you can view on your computer and move around and zoom in on. We also have a puzzle viewer where you can put together the bones of, I believe, a Hadrosaur as well as a Tyrannosaurus Rex. So you can place those together. And lastly, we have an interactive geologic timescale. So we have the timescale and you're able to click on certain periods, eons, eras, and look at certain events that are really important that happened during those times. So it's a lot more interactive than just sitting there and watching videos.
Do you think this is a better way to learn about paleontology than actually getting hands-on experience?
I think it's a really good way to bring paleontology to the masses and bring people who might not necessarily be interested in science or just kind of want to try things out. It's a great way to bring it to a lot of people. But I don't think it's a good way to completely replace like actual paleontology classes.
And where could people find Dino 101?
So you can go either to the University of Alberta website, which is ualberta.ca, and on the homepage they have a place where you can click on Dino 101 and follow the instructions there to sign up, or you can go to coursera.org and search for Dino 101 and you can sign up there and you can take it for free. And it'll start running again at the start of January, is the next session.
And are there any plans to expand it?
We have in the works right now a few mini MOOCs. So instead of being roughly a 12-hour course, which is what Dino 101 is, there may be 2 to 4 hours, and we're exploring things like early tetrapods, things like possibly fins to limbs, and a little bit of paleobiology. And so you can pick from those, and it's kind of, Dino 101 is going to be a required course to be able to take those little mini MOOCs. But yes, we are actually expanding it into more things. So hopefully we'll see that next September, I think, or maybe sooner. I'm not super sure.
Okay, Betsy, thank you very much.
You're absolutely welcome.
I'll see you again in a couple of days for your next interview.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode, and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.